Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Around these parts, the name Stormy Mayo is synonymous with right whales and the Center for Coastal Studies. Not only is he one of the founders of the center, his research of nearly five decades dramatically changed our understanding of right whale biology and behavior. Later this year, Stormy will retire after 48 years at the Center for Coastal Studies, and Daniel Palacios will take over as director of the Right Whale Ecology Program. Stormy and Daniel join us today to look back at Stormy's career and his contributions to Atlantic right whale research, and to look forward as the center continues its efforts to protect this critically endangered species. Welcome, Stormy, and welcome, Daniel.
Good morning.
Good to see you, Mindy.
All right, I'm going to start with you, Stormy. What was your path to marine biology and ecology as a career? How did you get interested in that?
Well, I worked as a teenager on the docks in Provincetown, a scientist at Woods Oceanographic Institution was studying tuna fish, and this was a big tuna landing port, and he was one of the people who started trying to figure out where the great bluefins, where they went, and whether the ones caught in Europe were the same ones that were over here. And so I was on the dock doing a lot of work with tuna. So fish is where I started, and in fact, where I completed my PhD. I didn't really work on whales until I got here back home in Provincetown.
Mm. So you were one of the three founders of the Center for Coastal Study. Your then wife, Barbara Schuller Mayo, and Graham Geis are the other two. Tell us a little bit more about when and why you decided to form the center.
You know, Mindy, I've said many times, and your listeners probably have heard me say it before, that really the center, from my point of view, was very much formed out of a lot of curious serendipity, lots of luck fit together, and chance. That story is a very long one, but basically, we didn't plan on building the Center for Coastal Studies. We three got together and thought it would be nice to just give some courses in marine science. And I was, frankly, in the process of trying hard to drop out of science and build a schooner, a big sailboat. And then the center grew up around that. It was a bit of a, I guess we'd say a bit of a chance operation. And by part of that chance, a fellow was starting whale watching out of Provincetown, the well-known dolphin fleet. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I'd go out, and I didn't want to work anymore on marine science till the boat was built. Kind of a radical view, but he had me go out, and I worked on humpback whales. And then after a while, Barbara had died, my wife, and Graham left the center and worked at Stony Brook. And I was there with two kids and sort of holding the Center for Coastal Studies bag. And luckily, we made it through that rather narrow passage. And the center now is a really surprisingly big operation. Yeah. A lot of chance.
Yeah, but if you could have looked into a crystal ball, you never would have believed it. We'd say what it's become.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So when, impossible to believe it.
Yeah. When you look back to the early 70s and into the 1980s, what were the pressing marine and ecological issues of the time then?
Well, the original one that brought us, the three of us together, was the Army Corps of Engineers plans to build to dredge huge amounts of Provincetown Harbor to build a solid fill pier, a sort of island and causeway complex. And so at that time, it was a battle that many communities were having over sort of unregulated dredging and filling, taking up parts of the bottom and using the sediment for building things. And so that was the big thing that got us together. But of course, all along there in down to today, there are the issues of all kinds of pollution. And then when whales came along, that was in a time when there were a lot of whales still being hunted. Still, there are some being hunted, and that was kind of a motivator for whale watching and for me to go out on whale watch boats.
So when did your focus and research turn to the Atlantic right whale? You mentioned you were on the boats and working mostly with humpback whales. Because these, at that time, were the whales really being studied at all here? They weren't, right?
No, the right whales were, in fact, in publication, were believed to not be here in the midwinter. But I met an ethnographer who wrote a monograph on her analysis of oil records, that is whale oil. And I met her on a memorable whale watch trip in the early spring when we actually saw right whales. And I said, you know, there's not supposed to be any here. Another bit of serendipity. This woman was just aboard the boat, and she said, well, you should read my monograph, which I eventually did. And she asserted that there was excellent information that right whales were here through the winter. And I had known from friends all over the Cape that they were sometimes seeing whales in the middle of the winter. So another serendipity, a fellow who heard about the center gave us a research vessel, our first research vessel. And he said, if you think they're here, and if Elizabeth Little thinks they're here, she was the author, here's the boat. See if you can find them. And that was the beginning in January of 85. We saw our first right whale in the bay. It's become a very odd situation that Daniel will be taking over, in that it seems like as the population has declined in this last 10 years or so, the number of whales of individuals visiting Cape Cod Bay has gone up. Not what you would expect. So we, in a sense, rediscovered what the Native Americans certainly must have known. Right whales were here in the winter.
But at that time, we didn't really know the population because nobody was out there really looking at it, right? So we didn't know when you first founded the center, we didn't know how many white whales were visiting. Was anybody concerned about the risk of extinction at that time? We probably not.
Yes, there was a concern because indeed it was obvious to people who went to sea that we weren't seeing very many. And they weren't coming to, people weren't looking in Cape Cod Bay very often. A fellow named Bill Watkins and his cohort, Bill Chaville, worked at Woods Hole. They would fly over the bay in the spring and they'd find an occasional right whale. So the numbers were thought to be low. Now we know that they were quite low. They went up to about 500 in 2010. And then they started on their slide, the one we're in right now. Now 350 animals.
So I mean, we were so excited when those numbers were going up, and now, oh boy. Daniel, what got you interested in marine biology?
Well, I grew up in Bogota, Colombia, which is high up in the Andes, nowhere near the ocean, but pretty much glued to the TV in terms of nature series and especially Jacques Cousteau series. So I was quite obsessed. I knew that I liked animals and I knew that I liked the ocean. I didn't really see the ocean until I was about 12 years old. And when it came time to go to college, I decided to study marine biology. That married the two passions that I had. And I moved out to a coastal town in the Caribbean called Cartagena in Colombia. And that was really incredible because I got to see and study a variety of coastal ecosystems, mangroves and coral reefs and rocky intertidals and all the classic environments that marine biologists study. But I had from early on my sights set on marine mammals, especially because of the power imagery that you get from those documentaries like Jacques Cousteau and many others that were being shown on Colombian TV. Even though I went down the path of marine science early on in college, I had my sights set on studying whales somehow, and there was no study of whales in Colombia, pretty much. Only maybe one or two people were doing some work there, and I got to work with them a little bit. But I knew that I had to come to the US for graduate studies and to pursue that further. So that's what got me started in my interest in that.
And you've spent a lot of your career in the Pacific Northwest. So tell us a little bit about your research.
Sure. What I've been working on in the last 10 years that I've been affiliated with Oregon State University has been a bit of a narrowing down of my interests. I'm broadly interested in ecology, marine ecology, but the specific job that I have here has to do with how we study whales using specific technology like tags, electronic tags that we put on the whales using a variety of attachment methods. And then we can track them for several amounts of time and learn about their movement. Some of the tags inform us about their diving behavior, their feeding behavior. And that has been pretty much my bread and butter, if you will, for the last 10 years in terms of studying mostly blue whales, fin whales, humpback whales, and sperm whales. Those have been our primary species of focus. But that said, we have had projects pretty much all over the world, where we have been able to track whales.
And I know you don't have the North Atlantic right whales on the West Coast, but you do have a right whale population, right? A different
North Pacific right whales, yes, we have a small remnant population. It's probably the most endangered or one of the most endangered species of whales in North America and in U.S. waters. And they are found, especially in summertime, they are found in the Bering Sea of Alaska and a little bit in the Gulf of Alaska on the Pacific side. Those are very hard to study as well because the eastern sector of that population is only believed to be less than 50 animals. So encountering them is quite the lottery, if you will, when you see them. So I have not been involved directly in studying them, but I'm definitely concerned about their conservation status.
Right. We're talking with Stormy Mayo, outgoing director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies, and the incoming director, Daniel Palacios, and we'll have more after a quick break. Listening to The Point, we're talking with Stormy Mayo, outgoing director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies, and the incoming director, Daniel Palacios. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have comments or questions for us this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Stormy, before your research, we didn't know that the right whales, as you were saying, spent a significant amount of time in Cape Cod Bay. Talk about your early research and what you discovered about how the whales used the water around Cape Cod.
Sure. Of course, initially, when we found the first one, we were jumping up and down, thrilled. But the animal, memorably, was right off of Truro inside the bay, and its mouth was wide open. And we hadn't seen open mouth skimming by right whales, huge mouths, and a giant, if you will, a biological plankton net this whale was using to filter the water. It's something we've now come to realize is typical of the right whales here and probably explains largely why they're here. If the food is good, they're here, and if not, they're not. It's part of the work we do now. So I think the most important part of the story is they are here right now. In fact, my boat is out looking at at right whale feeding. We do a lot of plankton studies. So the oddity is, incidentally, that even in those first years, we were studying right whales, but I think more time was put in looking through a microscope than taking pictures of whole whales. So we're looking at plankton. These whales now pretty clearly are using Cape Cod Bay as a feeding area, but also we see aggregations, social sexual aggregations, mating activity. And we also expect, probably in the next several days, to see the first mothers and calves come into the area from locations where the calving goes on south along the Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina coast. So it's a multi-use area and arguably is critical to the right whales, the area really of highest density seen anywhere around the Atlantic Basin.
Yeah, it's like a hot spot, you know, this time of year. Yeah, they come and anywhere we start seeing them, what, maybe December? I mean, I guess when they show up has sort of changed as maybe climate has changed, but they come, what, December and are usually gone by the beginning of May?
On the incoming part of the story, we actually for years had not done the kind of work we should at the beginning. I've seen them here in November, but of course, what you call a beginning is one whale a beginning, or do you need to have 10 whales? Departure used to be, we thought, sometime in mid-April, but now sometimes we see them all the way up until mid-May.
And how has this discovery of how the bay is used, how has that impacted conservation laws for the bay?
One of the critical parts of the work that we do, and it's really become central, is to work very closely with the state of Massachusetts to try to help control the amount of human activity in the bay in two different ways. One, to control the amount of rope that goes into the water to try to reduce entanglement, which is a big cause of mortality, and also to try to find whether there are enough whales for the state to ask that vessels go only 2 knots, I'm sorry, 10 knots. So there has been speed limits and fishing activity management, and it usually is based on the work we do with aerial survey. Our airplane is up in good weather days, and our boat is out. And if the food densities are high and the whales are seen here, the state of Massachusetts may, for instance, cause there to be speed limits within the bay. And that seems to be about as close a relationship between science and management that you can find. And well, it should be given the status of the population.
One of the things people I don't think realize is, as a just a recreational boat, you're not allowed to get in. Like it's quite a distance you have to keep from the right whales, right? But
Yes.
now you can walk along some of those areas. You can go to Herring Cove, or you can walk out to Race Point, and you actually can get a closer view when the whales are around and close to shore there than you would if you were in a boat.
Yes, absolutely. And I would recommend it for instance, the next several weeks. You may see nothing and just enjoy the scene, or you might see one of the rarest large mammals on Earth.
I know. It's
Pretty nice.
magic. It's funny. My husband grew up in Falmouth, and this was years ago. We walked out. We went, you know, walked out to the Race Point, and we came around the corner, and there were like 15 whales. It was so, and they, you know, seemed like they were so close because, you know, it drops off right there. And it was funny. He was like, how did I not know this? I've lived here my whole life. How did I not know? It was like this magical moment, you know, it's like, yeah, but you never can tell. You could go out there and see nothing. We just got lucky.
And there are lots of other whales that come in here. As Daniel will learn, there are plenty of animals that we don't know much about. and they are coming right in close to the land. So it's a great spot for whale research. And you don't have to go to the Bering Strait to find them. They're coming to your home.
Yeah. And birds. You can see all kinds of cool birds as well.
Yeah. Well, more often than not, when I was first starting the work, I was amazed. I could wake up in my bedroom, look out the window, and this time of year, I often would see right whales.
Yeah, amazing. I imagine you're really excited about this, Daniel, coming to Provincetown to do this work.
Very much looking forward to. In less than 2 months or so, I'll be there.
Yeah. Stormy, how common were entanglements and ship strikes at the beginning of your career compared to today?
I think they were a lot more common, but people didn't keep track of them. When we took a shot at trying to save the first whale, a humpback whale, that was entangled, trying to figure it out, Dave Matilla, who many people know from around here, and I both worked one day on a whale that I named years ago called Ibis, a humpback. It was dying in nets. And we took gear off it, but it was really not of much interest to people. And hence, it's like a lot of things in the world. If you don't look for something, you don't find it. And so it wasn't thought to be that common. We now know it was happening here and there all along the East Coast and, in fact, all around the world. So both ship strikes and entanglements were probably much more common than we thought. It looked like there weren't many. But
we just didn't know it, yeah.
Now we're paying attention.
Yeah. Center for Coastal Studies started a disentanglement program. And this is, I don't know, people realize, this is really dangerous work. At that time, not many people knew how to do it safely. Talk about getting that program up and running and how you trained yourselves. And you've actually invented some of these tools that you use.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it kind of happens the way probably a lot of inventions happen, and that is you find something you want to do and you try to figure out how to do it.
Well, there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah, well, everybody does it in their lives, whether it's cooking or cutting grass or whatever. You usually figure things out if you need to have it done. And in this case, it was a little more perilous trying to deal with the first humpbacks. And over years, about 20 years of doing it, it was my sons eventually, after 20 years, said, you need to get out of the bow of the boat, because very often I would depend on Dave Matilla to run the outboard, and we'd be in a little inflatable, and I'd be up in the bow. Neither he nor I trusted me to run the engine, so I ended up in front of the boat. You know, when you first do something that you know could kill you, it's a good deal of stress. But we caught on to a bunch of things, and I'm happy to say that in our project, for all the work that's done, we now have a full disentanglement program at the center. No longer do those of us doing other kinds of research have to get in a boat and go out and work on animals, and the new disentanglement team at the center is very active and has developed a whole bunch of new approaches, being directed by Scott Landry at our laboratory. But in those early days, it was, how do we do this? And so we developed a number of techniques that came from the old whaling. My father was one of the last whalers in Provincetown, probably the last. And he, in fact, suggested the techniques that we used on the first disentanglement to use kegs to stop the whale, putting kegs on long ropes. And that was a technique he suggested the day we did that disentanglement. We were trying to figure out what to do. We had a whale with rope on it. What do you do? And he said, you know, put a grapple in it and a couple of hundred feet of line and a keg. Well, we didn't have a keg, but we had a big orange float, and that was the beginning of the technique.
Yeah, because the whales don't know you're trying to help them, right? So that's part of the problem, right? Why it's so dangerous, yeah.
Yeah, some people say, oh, they know, and why don't they help you more? And I wouldn't dare say what they know, but it doesn't appear to me, it appears to me like they're trying to get away from an aggravating little boat with a couple of guys in orange suits trying to hassle them. So
yeah.
when they're in pain and suffering, which they certainly are, I'd suggest they're not really that interested in working with us. One would suspect that they don't know what's going on.
Right. I think one of the things, it's terrible what they go through. As you mentioned, they're in a lot of pain, and to sometimes that rope has been in there for a while, and it's infection, and it's a really terrible way to die. And a lot of people, I think, don't know. And Michael Moore's always saying, if this were a land animal and you could see the suffering, more people would be outraged at what these whales go through. Maybe Churchill was the first time people really started, as far as the general public I'm talking about, really started to pay attention to what's happening. Do you think that was about the first time when we had the issue with Churchill?
Well, I think it's been kind of on a trajectory. But yeah, anytime it has a lot to do with people like you. When it gets in the news, then it makes a difference. It's a little like the whole business of whaling. I mean, there was a time when my father was hunting pilot whales that nobody could have cared. But then, you know, a talking head on the news describes how horrific these entanglements are, and we all care, and that leads us that way. So, I mean, I think, like many environmental issues, the news makes a big difference because it gets into the minds of people who never even see a whale or the ocean even.
I'm thinking back, you know, when you go out and you're doing your plankton studies, the whales get pretty close to your boat, and your boat is not very big when you look at the size of these whales. I'm just thinking of the one time where the whale came under the boat and sort of lifted it a little bit. But when you think about, I remember being on the boat once with you and seeing this whale look like it's coming straight for us. And of course, it sees us and goes the other way. But have you had any kind of scary moments there where you think they might accidentally topple your boat, other than the time where it kind of came up underneath? And it didn't topple the boat, by the way, yeah.
No. Well, I'll tell you, I haven't had really any scary moments when we're working in a research profile. There have been a few scary moments, for sure, on some very difficult disentanglements that I well remember. One in Canada and a couple down here in U.S. waters. And part of the scariness of it is that we have had a really special guy up in, I think, the Gulf of St. Lawrence a number of years ago, was killed
right,
trying to disentangle a whale. And he was a trained fellow. He had worked with us and received training. And just by chance, and a terribly sad chance, he was killed. I used to think that whales, even when being disentangled, knew where everything was and they were not aiming for us. So some of the scary moments that I remember from disentanglement, I now look back and think it was just, again, luck, serendipity.
Yeah.
It didn't hit us.
We're talking
and,
with
you know, this closeness business is something that I I think Daniel is going to have a lot of fun with. There's
Oh,
going to
yeah.
be I'm anxious to have him see what we can do in terms of taking food almost out of the mouths of right whales to find out what they're eating.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dan. You want to react to
Well, yeah, as long as we're not having to wrestle the food out of their mouths, that's so
that?
good. And yeah, in the line of work that we do for putting tags on whales, we have to get very close to them. And I can certainly attest to what Stormy said about just being lucky by chance because, yeah, they can react very suddenly and they are very fast and
Oh.
big, strong. Yeah.
And so you mentioned earlier some of the activity we see in the bays, like when they get together for these like mating rituals, if you don't want to be anywhere near that. That's some pretty wild splashing around and they're big. And so when you see something activity starting like that, you want to hightail it out of there, right?
Well, after a while, our captains and the people who work the boat know pretty well what's likely to happen. But in those mating groups, they are a little less predictable. They are really the male. It's usually a number of males and a female, although there could be switches around in that. But you get the sense that you can't be sure about them because they're paying attention to each other. And you can, if you want, get very close. It's probably not wise.
We're talking
And
with Stormy.
let me
Yeah,
add,
go ahead.
Cindy, that just for people in this area, I'd like to just amplify what you said, and that is that there is for people without a federal permit, which the center carries, it is not legal to get within 500 yards
Okay.
of a right whale.
Right.
So, and there are a lot of people out there now who are from the Environmental Police and Coast Guard who are keeping track of that. So,
Yeah.
public should stay at a distance and indeed watch them from the beach, which sometimes can be amazing.
Yeah. We're talking with Stormy Mayo, outgoing director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies, and the incoming director, Daniel Palacios, and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Stormy Mayo, who is the outgoing director of the Right Whale Ecology Program, retiring a little bit later this year at the Center for Coastal Studies, and the incoming director, Daniel Palacios. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Daniel, you'll be heading up the Right Whale Ecology Program at a critical moment. It's possible that in our lifetime we might see the extinction of this species. Talk a little bit about why you want to take on this job.
Yeah. So this opportunity offers really interesting options for looking back at what has been done. Stormy has been setting up this program. I'm developing this program for 40 years or so. So we have a fantastic time series of observations and measurements and prey for right whales. And so there's a rich data set there to look and to mine and to find patterns there for what how these oscillations might have happened over time in relation to things like climate variability and population changes and so forth. And obviously, looking forward, as you well said, the population it is at a dire place right now, and we must do everything we can to ensure its survival. So I'm looking forward to working with the community of right whale researchers who have been very active in terms of coming up with ways of better understanding the impacts of all these stressors that have been mentioned earlier today, entanglements and noise and ship strikes and ship traffic and all of that. So certainly, I think we have in this day and age, we have a lot of technology, a lot of information. There's a lot of information that we didn't have before about things we can do to protect these animals. And interestingly, I think that a lot of them have more to do with changing our own behavior, really, rather than doing much with the whales themselves. I think a lot of that has to do with becoming more aware of our footprint in the ocean, whether it's from garbage and that kind of how that is handled and how we mitigate our use of plastics. You know, microplastics are another concern these days. It's just a variety of things that are all basically downstream, just or upstream really are being caused by our own behavior and our own patterns of consumption and so forth. That I think overall, we with some modifications, we can hopefully mitigate some of the bigger impacts. You know, we understand now that reduction in speed, for example, is one of the best ways to mitigate ship strikes, for example, and so forth. So there's quite a variety of things we can do, probably engaging a wide variety of stakeholders and people who are involved in the various activities that are going on, and together work for more solutions.
One of the areas I read that you want to explore is how the whales are responding to climate change. What are you hoping to do there? I mean, because I mean that shifts where they make the food source shifts, the whales shift, right?
Yeah, and Stormy alluded to this earlier about how the population and the number of animals that show up in Cape Cod in relation to the entire population has been changing. And last week there was a paper published by Jason Roberts and a large team of people, really, from Duke University and other collaborators, documenting this kind of changes since 2004 or so to the present in terms of how these pockets of high and low abundance or density of whales have changed and shifted over the last couple of decades along along the East Coast of the United States. So that speaks to there being a lot of underlying causes for these changes, which, as you said, are primarily prey-driven. So that's why that time series of data and samples that Stormy has collected over the last several decades, last 4 decades or so, has the potential to really inform what climate influence, how what kind of influence we have from climate on the whales. It is well known now that there's natural oscillations in the climate. So obviously, human-induced climate change is just one flavor or one source of climate variability that it's overimposed on a number of other kinds of natural climate oscillations. We talk about the North Atlantic Oscillation. You hear about El Niño. Those are examples of natural climatic oscillations that also have an impact on the prey base. So the interesting thing is to try and disentangle those various sources of variability and change, and how they might be influencing the prey for the right whales in different ways.
Yeah. Stormy, you mentioned there's about 350 or so of these whales left, and it's very concerning. And you mentioned that the moms and calves will be arriving soon. Where do you know where we are in the populations as numbers of females? Because somewhere there's going to be a tipping point, right? If you don't have enough females to reproduce, that's the end of the species.
Yeah, the story there is troubling. These animals should have a as many mammals do should have a ratio of one male to one female, and because of what appears to be a shorter lifespan, a higher mortality rate in the female part of the population. The right whales now are showing about two males for every one female. The female population is more susceptible to a number of different things. It's not clear exactly why they're lower, but females are certainly more susceptible to a bunch of impacts. Among other things, of course, females are going through the whole business of producing young, which is a substantial strain on their physiology. So indeed, it is worrisome that there are fewer females than males. The females are dying out, and that's the engine of the population. To boot, a number of the females that exist are not reproducing or reproducing at a much lower rate. So reproduction side of the story is not good. And the mortality side of it from human causes is also not good. And that's the combination that you don't want.
Right. And when you say not reproducing, I remember recently there was a story in the news of a female, I forgot what her age was, and they were attributing some of that to stress. I mean, she had ship strike scars. And I mean,
yes.
Yeah. So the stress of just existing is really causing a big problem in this reproduction area, right?
Yeah. And I think 80% or thereabouts of the population have scars that indicate entanglement. And there are likely quite a few whales that have been hit by ships, some of which don't even show up as scars. They're blunt trauma. The combination of those on a female who is also in reproductive phase is a stress that is believed to cause the kind of higher mortality that we're seeing from females.
Mm. And what can we do? What do we do? How do we help them?
Well, it's Daniel covered that very well. It's the intersection of human activities, all the way from climate change down to such things as entanglement and ship strike. It's a lot of human behavior. You and me, mm-hmm. I expect to be driving today. That's I have an electric car, but the electricity comes from somewhere. And so there's an example. I'm part of the problem, and we all are.
Mm. You know, we mentioned you're going to be retiring, but that doesn't mean you're going to be sitting in a rocking chair in your front porch, right? I mean, you're still going to be studying whales? I mean, how do you give up something you're passionate about, right?
I might sit in a rocking chair on the front porch, but I don't have a front porch, so I'll have to figure that one. Maybe build a front porch. I've talked with our executive director, and I've mentioned to Daniel that really much under his guidance, there are a couple of things that I am anxious to follow up on. And I'm also looking forward to working with Daniel as he sort of gets used to who the people are that you talk to around here, like Mindy Todd is an example. Getting to know what the situation is. And I'm on a bunch of different committees as he is, but there are some that he's not on, and we need to get him working in those. So I'm going to be hanging around at a lower level, and I hope if it's okay with him to follow up on a couple of the things that I'm very much interested in, but haven't had an opportunity to work on, and now I'll have an opportunity.
And so, Daniel, you're going, phew, I got a new best friend.
Yes. Well, that's the way I view it, definitely, because there's a lot of work to be done. And certainly, with our capacity to only, limited time and so forth, certainly having Stormy remaining involved will be a blessing for all of us. So definitely looking forward to working together with him.
Yeah. I'm wondering for each of you, if there's been a significant aha moment in your career, perhaps when you solved a mystery about whale ecology, behavior, something. Is there an aha moment that stands out for either of you in your careers?
I'll give that to Daniel while I think about it.
Sure. There's been a few aha moments for sure for me in my career. One early one I mentioned after I went to college and did some work on the Caribbean side of things. I had the opportunity to go to the Galapagos Islands with an organization created by Roger Payne and Ian Kerr, which mm-hmm. Who are based in Massachusetts. They were taking a sailboat to the Galapagos Islands for a whole year to study sperm whales there. And I was lucky enough that I got to go on that expedition, and I worked around the Galapagos Islands for about that whole year. And the aha moment came when, after long hours of observation up on the crow's nest of the sailboat, it struck me that as we traveled around the islands, we would see very dramatic changes in the types of whale and dolphin species that we would see based on the part of the archipelago that we were. And these changes were very strongly associated with water temperature. So at that moment, I had this understanding that what I really wanted to focus on was studying these animals in their environment, because the environment has such a powerful driver of where and where they are found. And that's where I decided what I really need to study for my graduate studies is oceanography, which is that combination of studying the animals, but also how the environment is varying and how that environment influences where and where we find them.
Mm. How about you, Stormy?
Well, I think for me, there's sort of been a very long aha that spreads through virtually all of what I have done in my life, as well as with whales, but certainly showing with whales, and it follows somewhat on what Daniel's mentioned, and that is that to understand these animals, we have to understand them at the scale that they're understanding the ocean. And in particular, there was this feeling that we all had, in fact, that there are these great, maybe 100 miles worth of plankton over big areas, and that's the plankton that whales are eating. It turns out that if you literally watch the whales interacting with patches of food, with big layers of food that you can see in some cases, it is really the small scale that matters to these animals, because the environment here in Cape Cod Bay, and I'm sure elsewhere, is actually very finely divided. And they are paying attention to the areas of intense richness. And that richness forms on very small scale oceanography, matters of centimeters in some cases, if you're a plankton organism. And so I've often said at many meetings and whatever, it's great to model right whales and to understand how they're interacting, but you've got to go to the building blocks, which in right whales in Cape Cod Bay may be 50 centimeters horizontally and maybe 10 centimeters vertically. It's not that the whole bay is rich and provides the food. It is that there are small pockets where the food is found. And of course, that's true of the ecosystem that humans work with. We eat in little tiny areas, and we travel on other scales to other areas, like migration.
Yeah.
So scale is critical, and a lot of us miss that fact, that little tiny scales are important to right whales and should be to us.
Stormy Mayo is the director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at Center for Coastal Studies, retiring a little later this year. And incoming director, Daniel Palacios, thank you. And Daniel, good luck. I'm sure we'll be chatting more in the future as you make your way to Provincetown. Thanks for being here this morning.
I look forward to that. Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.